you, Sharon, as we've been over these past few weeks talking about the reasons that any informed and rational person should reject half of the Christian New Testament out of hand, all of the letters written by Paul. They are universally errant. They're inconsistent with the Yahweh's testimony. They are inspired by the adversary, not by God. And we have been reviewing them, and we will continue to do so. We began in chapter 1 of a book called Questioning Paul. It can be found at questioningpaul.com. It's about 1,200-page analysis of Paul's first letter, of his letter to the Galatians. And in our audio review of that book, here as part of this program, we're on the second verse now of the first statement. And throughout this exercise, so that you are not just dependent upon my translations, and I have done my best to create accurate translations of Greek that are adjusted to reflect the oldest manuscript of Paul's letters, which is Papyrus 46, dated to the late 1st, early 2nd century, so within 50 years probably of the time that Paul actually wrote his letter. To the Galatians, which was probably in 50 or 51 CE. It's his first. It was written in response to the Jerusalem Council, where he was taken to task for preaching that was wholly inconsistent with Yahweh's Torah. And so in Galatians, he is attempting to not only defend himself, but to establish his credentials, and then to establish his doctrine, and then to establish his reason for being opposed to that which Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, advocated in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And throughout this process, I've been committed to providing not only my own translation, but also an interlinear translation that's a literal translation, the one that's associated with the Nestle Aland, which is the most revered, the most scholarly text of Paul's letter, called the McReynolds Interlinear. I shared that with you. We're also sharing the Latin Vulgate because it had the greatest influence on promoting Paul and the religion of Christianity as Christianity grew out of Rome and the Roman Empire. For a better part of 1,000 years, it was the only text that you could read because the oldest manuscripts that we are considering had not been unearthed. And so the only legal copy you could have was be the Latin Vulgate, other than the Greek Orthodox churches had Greek manuscripts that they read from. And we're sharing that, translated, of course, into English, the King James, because it had such an effect on Europe and the United States, as well as sharing the New Living Translation, since it's the most recent Christian and evangelical translation. And in this particular case, I want to share the New Living Translation's variation of Galatians 1:2. It reads, "All of the brothers and sisters here join me in sending this letter to the churches in Galatians, in Galatia." Now, it's important that you know, because there's a bunch of people that have bought New Living Translations that hold them up and say this is the inerrant word of God, that beyond the fact that Paul is, according to God, the plague of death, and therefore his letters would not be the word of God, but the word of the adversary. In the actual text of Paul's letters, there is no Greek basis whatsoever for "and sisters." There's no word. You know, there's a Greek word for sister, and it's not there. There's no word for "here." There's no basis for "join me." There is no basis for "in sending." There is no basis for this letter. And ecclesia, which is what Paul wrote, means called out, not churches. So here is this statement. "All the brothers and sisters here join me in sending this letter to the churches of Galatia and yet there's no textual basis for, and sisters here, join me in sending this letter. And ecclesia means called out, not churches. Wow. Did they get anything right other than of Galatia? Equally misleading, the New Living Translation created a new sentence replete with a verb to make it appear as if Paul wasn't actually engaged in a long-winded diatribe. You see, Corinthians 1:2 isn't a sentence. It's a dependent clause in a run-on sentence. Also worth noting, only Galatians amongst Shauls, that was his real name, he changed it to a Latin or Roman name, Apollos, first five letters went out under his name alone. First and second Thessalonians were sent from Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy. First Corinthians was from Paul and Sosthenes. While the immediately troublesome and indeed demonic epistle of 2 Corinthians, where Paul admits that he was insane and that he was demon-possessed, bears Timothy's name in addition to Paul's. In today's vernacular, Paul wrote Galatians before his posse was popular. The evidence suggests that this letter was dictated in haste, immediately after the Jerusalem summit, immediately before Paul fell in love with Timothy. Equally telling is that while Shaul will acknowledge Barnabas in this epistle, since the two served their relationship in the immediate aftermath of the Jerusalem summit, he was excluded from the greeting and demeaned in the midst of a rather mean-spirited rant. It's important to know why this letter differs from the others that included names. Well, now you know. This next dependent clause in Paul's letter is an example of why it is so difficult to determine what Paulus was trying to say and for us to ascertain why he chose to be so provocative. At issue here, there is no verb. And charis, Greek, and gratia, Latin, is the collective name of a very popular pagan trio of goddesses. They were the goddesses of merriment, merriment, of partying, lasciviousness. For those of you who have been fortunate to travel and have seen ancient ruins like Pompeii and Herculaneum or the Roman ruins in Ephesus, what you find is that in the homes of Roman elitists, now Roman society was very stratified. You had the elitists who had rights to do essentially everything. There was a Roman citizens beneath them that had very few rights. They were called plebes, so patricians and plebes. And then beneath them were foreigners who had less rights even than the plebes, but yet were still free men. And they had another set of laws pertaining to them. And then under the Roman caste system, beneath them were slaves. And slaves had no rights. And so in this stratified society, in the home of the patricians and the elitists of Rome, what you find is that their homes, particularly the common rooms, are almost always decorated with a pagan relief. And overwhelmingly, the choice of elitist Romans was the charis, which they call the gratia, the charities or the graces. And they're always naked. They're always having great fun. They're always engaged in frivolity, and it's not the sense that they're goddesses of merriment in the sense of real joy of families bonding together. No, this is merriment in the sense of lust. This is merriment in the sense of hedonism and of gorging oneself with food and with drink and with sex. That's the kind of merriment that the charities and gratia graces represented. So, that be known. Paul wrote charis, grace, the name of the loving and lovely, I should say, and lascivious Greek goddesses of merriment, known to the Romans as gratia, from which grace is derived. To you, and peace from God, Father of us, and Lord, Iesu Christu. In this particular case, in the P46 manuscript, the oldest manuscript of this letter, one written about 50 years probably, on all likelihood, maybe 75 after Paul originally penned it. This P46 was a manuscript penned in a scribal facility in Alexandria. They added placeholders for God, placeholders, and the God was Theta Upsilon, placeholder for Lord, placeholders for Iesu, and a placeholder for Christu. I have simply attempted to return the text to the condition that is most likely that Paul himself would have written. Now, thankfully, charis is not found in the earliest and foundational books. The disciple Matanya and Mark, who was under the influence, Mark simply wrote down what he heard the disciple Shimon Kephesh, known to the world as Peter, had to say. So you won't find charis in either the text of Matanyahu or Mark. The Christian fixation on charis and the Roman manifestation gratia is therefore a direct result of Paul's letters. Charis appears 170 times in the self-proclaimed apostles' letters and another 14 times in Acts, a book written almost entirely about Paul and for Paul. We'll consider charis when Shattering Myth returns after the commercial break. The only other mentions of the pagan goddesses, the cute naked goddesses for merriment, appear in the Greek texts of charis after the publication of Paul's epistles, as we find charis used in one conversation in Iaukonon, which is John. Iaukonon means Yahweh is merciful. 1:14-17. It is found four times in Luke, a book written from Paul's perspective, of which there are no first, second, or third century manuscripts to verify any of those inclusions. Of the remaining 16 occurrences, all but two are sprinkled in the poorest attested books. 10 in Shimon Peter's letters, of which there is no reliable first, second, or third century manuscript. The late 3rd century Papyrus 72 is extremely free, meaning imprecise and subject to substantial copy edits and alterations, which suggests that it was heavily influenced by Marcion, someone who we'll talk about in due time. You find it twice in Jacob James, of which there is no pre-Constantine manuscript of the passage, 4:6, which it appears. Once in 2nd Iaukonon, John, of which there is no pre-Constantine manuscript, and once in Jude, but in P78 doesn't include the fourth verse where charis has now been inserted, indicating that that it was added by a scribe whose agenda was other than accuracy. The first use of charis in Revelation 1:4 is attested only by a fragment too small to validate, which appears to have been written by an untrained and unprofessional scribe, as determined by the penmanship. And in the early 4th century, on Papyrus 18, which is also unreliable. The second purported inclusion of cherries found in Revelation 22:21, but there is no pre-Constantine manuscript that covers anything in Revelation, beginning with the 17th chapter through the end of the book. So it cannot be validated. Therefore, apart from the one poorly attested inclusion, there is no verification that cherries was used by anyone other than Paul prior to the early 4th century. Now, the reason this is an issue is because charis is the name of the three Greek graces known as the charities. The English word for charity is a transliteration of their name. These pagan goddesses of charm, of splendor, of beauty, are often depicted in mythology celebrating nature and rejoicing over fertility. They were overtly erotic. They were the porn stars before there was porn. Collectively, they make four appearances in Homer's Iliad and three in the Odyssey. In the order of their appearances, they are depicted offering bedroom attire to Aphrodite, to participating in a ruse to trick Zeus, to serving to lure Hypnos via promises of sex, to mislead the father of the gods, and as objects of beauty when splattered with blood as the source of feminine attractiveness and handmaidens, and then as those who pampered Aphrodite after she was caught being unfaithful to her husband. Then finally, the cherries are said to have been the means to enchant through other gods through erotic dancing. Now, if you're going to base a doctrine, the doctrine of grace, salvation through faith in the doctrine of grace, grace-based salvation, essential to evangelical Christianity, essential to Paul's letters, on girls that are sex objects, on goddesses that were conniving and who specifically tried to lure other pagan goddesses to infidelity through seductiveness. I don't know how you could pick a worse choice or make a worse choice. And yet that is the Christian basis of their doctrine of salvation through faith and grace. The reality here is in the case of Aphrodite, the graces bathed her. They anointed her with special oils. They are shown having dressed her in delightful apparel so that she might resume her bedroom and loving duties after having been caught in an embrace of love with Aaron. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the cherries. We've just shared Homer's presentation of them in the Iliad and the Odyssey. There was one additional one that I did not share, is that Homer also uses the lure of the graces, the charities, to depict what he calls the beauty of war. Now, some accounts attest that the graces, the charities, were the daughters of Zeus. Others claim that the cherries were the daughters of Dionysus and Aphrodite. And that is particularly troublesome because Paul claims to hear one of Dionysus's most famous quotes during his conversion experience on the road to Damascus. Glenn, welcome back. My guess is that you're aware that Paul actually quoted Dionysus's most famous line.
Why do you insist on kicking against the goats? Why? You make it so hard for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, most people don't know what a goat is. If you use it in context, people are aware. You know, you're goaded along. If you turn goad into a verb, people, an actionable thing, people would know what goad means if you're goaded along. A goad is a was a sharp pointed stick. It was also equated to a scorpion stinger, and sometimes there was even thorns used as part of a goad. But a goad is a thorn or sharp pointed stick or scorpion stinger that was specifically used to herd dumb animals. So if you wanted an animal to go someplace and you didn't want to try to entice them to go there, you just wanted to maneuver them there, then you would use a goad. And if the animal chose to resist against that goad, that sharp pointed stick, that would cause injury to them. And so Dionysus's most famous line was to those who were in the population who spoke out against his mythology, and he says, you know, it's going to be difficult for you to resist the goad. That is absolutely
right.
True.
Right.
Yeah, you're a man of letters.
And that's actually, I'm calling to talk about letters and words.
Hey, by the way, do you know where the play this was the most famous line from the play, where the play was written and first viewed?
I'm going to give you a clue.
It's the same country from which the most famous general of all time emerged, and the same country from which the beast, the Antichrist, will emerge.
Oh, well, these are the most famous generals. See, part of me is thinking either hero of Rome, because we use the word hero, and he was a general, we had the word hero, or I'm thinking, you know, Miltiades of Greece, but I'm not sure which general you're wanting.
Yeah, Alexander the Great was probably the most people would know. Alexander the Great is the greatest general of all time. He's a Macedonian. And the beast, the Taurus one of the tribulation, the guy known as the Antichrist, although he won't be anti-anything Christian. He's going to embrace all of Christian mythology. He's going to come from Macedonia. The play that we're talking about was actually written in Macedonia, where the Dionysus cult was celebrated and first played in Macedonia. Uh-huh. A little trivia for my trivia friend.
I wasn't crediting Alexander with being a general, being a 20-something kid who's probably mostly had handlers, but you know.
Yeah, you know who is who Alexander's primary handler was? Aristotle.
Aristotle.
You know how Aristotle.
No. I'm talking about the succession of the philosophers. Socrates.
Oh, okay.
Plato,
Yes. Right. Aristotle was motivated to school the young Alexander. I think it was either for 2 or 3 years, because Philip, Alexander's father, had a nasty tendency to go into towns that wouldn't submit to him. You see, Greece at the time was just a collection of city-states. And if a city would either capitulate and agree to pay a tariff, a tribute to one king or another, and if a community wouldn't agree to pay Philip a tribute, then he would annihilate them.
So he was a Muslim,
same kind of thing. And so Aristotle, the Greeks get this rap for being, you know, they're publicists. They were philosophers and they were scientists and they were Democrats and they had such a lovely society. No, they were thugs. The town from which Aristotle came from, Philip had under siege, and so Philip's encouraged Aristotle to educate his son by telling him that he wouldn't destroy the town so long as Aristotle taught him willingly.
That's an interesting form of scholarship, very different than sports scholarship.
Yeah, that's a very different. I won't kill your family. I won't destroy your town if you take 2 years to teach my kid.
Yeah, it's a military scholarship. Anyway,
by the way, you know what's interesting, too, is in all likelihood, Alexander worked with his mother to kill his father. Alexander and Philip were enemies. They hated one another, and it's highly likely that Alexander, scheming with his mother, poisoned his father.
Wow. Well, how fitting that the story of Oedipus Rex came from that part of the world.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. There you go. The Oedipus complex. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, oh, boy, boy. So I derive great benefit from your giving, like, historical context to these things. You know, I'm thinking, and when I hear you talk, teach on these things, I think, like, hey, I should have been hearing more of this when I was in college. You know, when you're talking about Paul, the social setting where he was, communicating with people and then and stuff.
You know,
like
I really appreciate that. Because, you know, that's my view, too, is that we, well, in fact, my last two chapters, one is published, the other is not published yet, where I go to really great lengths to provide the historical context. I actually think we can learn a lot from how people have behaved in history and how their legacies have been changed to present them so differently than the actual history was.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, history is written by the victors and all that. And it's just with whisper down the lane. If everything, so much of what we think we know is just wrong, you know.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, we think of Sparta and we only think of the 300 at Thermopylae that stood their ground to prevent the Persian onslaught and sacrificed it all. And yet we don't think of Sparta as the longest test of democracy in world history and how that society stopped working and they enslaved the nearby community of Greeks to produce all of their food and all of their shelters, and they turned their women into nothing but bomb-making facilities, weapons-making facilities, as bearing new sons that could produce new warriors, and that the children were, you know, grotesquely abused to make them tough.
Right.
And that, you know, it was a warrior culture that emerged from the world's longest-lasting democracy. It's I think there's a lot we can learn.
The contrast between them and the Athenians, you know, you see that in the 300, you know, the Klingons versus the Vulcans, that kind of stuff.
In this case, there was evil against evil.
Right, both unviable because of their excesses and their imbalance. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about was the linguistic stuff.
You're talking about. Can I interrupt you one thing? Because I do want to go to that. But there's one lesson that Americans really need to hear. And you spoke about Athens and the failure of Athens. Athens was the first country as a city-state to actually try to impose democracy. And what they did is they formed the Delian League to get the islands of the Aegean to accept democracy. And they said, you either accept democracy or, you know, we're going to destroy you. So they imposed democracy, kind of like what America is trying to do in Iraq and Iran. And they did it because they wanted a tripwire for the Persians. They wanted the Persians to have to stumble over allies before they got to Athens. And so they imposed their form of government on the islands in the Aegean Sea. And that was what was called the Delian League. And so the first attempt to impose democracy on another country failed miserably. And that's exactly what, because we didn't learn that lesson, is what America attempted to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, it failed miserably there as well.
Right. Democracy is a precursor to chaos and tyranny.
Yeah, particularly when you're trying to impose it, you're trying to force people to accept a system that you're supposed to be able to choose.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, especially when you have, like, you know, the adage that democracy is, you know, two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for lunch, you know.
In democracy, the reason that America's founding fathers were opposed to democracy is there's a huge difference between democracy and representative government. In a democracy, to have a true democracy, the people decide everything. The elected officials can carry out the people's will, but the people decide everything. So you vote for how much tax, you vote for how much to spend, you vote for whether or not you're going to send your sons and daughters off to war. Every decision, where you build a bridge, where you build a road, what the country invests in, what it's going to teach, the people in a democracy choose everything. There are no democracies in the world today.
That's a great example of that in the movie Idiocracy. We've got a bunch of totally ignorant people just making decisions about things about which they know nothing.
Yeah, and in today's world, you could not have, not only are there no democracies, you could have no democracy in the world today because people aren't well enough educated on these subjects to make intelligent decisions.
I was stunned. fun when one of my high school teachers said, you know, there's always this emphasis, at age 17, I'm getting ready to be 18 and vote. And everybody, the emphasis is register to vote, 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 get out there and vote, vote. Is a two-space name, vote, you know, vote, 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 vote. And my high school teacher said, if you don't know what you're talking about, if you don't know what you're voting for,
right,
don't vote. You're only muddying
yeah.
the waters. I'm like,
yeah.
that rocked me back. I was like, wow.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't know yeah. the history of America's 101 wars, you shouldn't be voting to empower politicians to engage in more wars. If you don't know the history of the Federal Reserve, a private cartel banking system and the use of fiat money, then you ought not be voting for people that are going to administer taxation and spending.
Right. Right.
That's
and
just the bottom line. You ought not be doing it because you like one party right. versus another. That's not, you ought not be voting unless you're smarter than that.
Yeah. This idea that there's some inherent virtue to voting, if, even if you don't know what you're talking about.
No. Yeah, that's kind of the, the publicized myth that there's some inherent virtue to serving in the military. Even though the military has been counterproductive for almost all of America's history. Glenn, we're going to return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break, and I've enjoyed this distraction. That's not where you wanted to go, but I appreciate you you working with me through it. The entire last segment will be yours to talk about language, which is, I think, why you called. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I made a promise to Glenn, and without further interruption by the host, I hope, though, that you did enjoy our migration through through history there. We'll listen to what you have to say about the history of words.
Well, also, like I was also going to mention, the placement of the various verses and
okay.
Codices and fragments, that's also, you know, wow, you know, this stuff didn't exist, or words,
yeah.
putting in words that weren't there and stuff like that. That's huge. That's usually helpful. I wanted to talk about pronunciation issues a bit, though. You were saying Charisse, which in English we have a woman's name, Charisse, which is, you know, often called, or Charisse. You know, mm-hmm. they're often called Cherry. The woman might be named Cherry if she's Cherise. Why anyone would want to name their daughter that, given what you just explained about the etymology of the word, is like beyond me, because they obviously don't know.
Yeah, by the way, you know, I didn't know until fairly recently, because, like, my wife, one of her favorite names was after Princess Grace, you know, the woman, the actress that married into the royal family of Monaco.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
so she loved the name Grace because of Princess Grace and how elegant Grace Kelly was as she married
right.
into that royal family. And, you know, I didn't have, for years, I didn't have any problem with it. And then you search
yeah.
its history and the what the graces were, and all of a sudden you say,
probably
not a good thing.
Well, yeah, and I'll visit that from a philosophy of language standpoint in just a second. But just to stick with pronunciation for a minute. In Greek, and we're talking about Hellenistic or Koine Greek. There are different ages of Greek. There's Hellenic Greek and modern Greek,
right.
and,
mm-hmm.
and the Greek of the Bible is Hellenistic or Koine. But in Koine, it wouldn't be Charisse, of course. It's Charis. That's like where we get charismatic. We change the Char
right.
with the H. So,
right.
so people are confused. Like strictly the pronunciation would be Charis, you know,
right.
in the Greek. And then... and in terms of pronunciation, in terms of Jesus, you're looking at an iota, eta, omicron, upsilon, sigma.
Yeah, because it's the same chi that forms the Christ. The CH is the same, and you're right. It changes in its pronunciation from Hellenistic to Koine.
Yeah. Well, it would never be, and it wouldn't, in the Hellenistic, it might have transformed, like in Latin, you know, like Jesus. Iesus in a Hellenistic or Koine Greek is Iesus. You're never going to get an Iusu out of that. You might transition toward that in the Latin or something somehow, but you're never going to get an I sound, because that would be like an alpha, iota, diphthong followed by an upsilon. You know, so since you just have an iota and an eta, it's always going to be Iesus. Which we kind of make like a lot. So, yeah, it's always Jesus.
Right.
So,
yes.
you know, just the pronunciation thing a little bit. And then in terms of the way.
Yeah, so the I,
like,
the IE would be IE, Seuss. So
no, it's not an E, really. It's an ADA. So EA, it would be an A sound. So it's EA. So that, you know,
The sound of the ATA meaning more of an E sound.
Right.
Not that it, I mean, again, here we're talking about linguistic pronunciations, transliteration,
right,
ideas out of one of the three forms of Greece. You know, whether or not you get it accurate, well, it's better to be accurate than not accurate, but you're dealing
right
with a pronunciation that dates to a time 2,000 years ago.
Right, because I've even had, like, when I did my one semester in grad school and seminary, I had an Athenian roommate, you know, who would challenge the professor's pronunciations, and the professor would defend and say, well, he's coming at it from the standpoint of a modern Grecian, you know, modern Greek.
Right.
And there's actually very good indication that in the Koine, it would have, you know, been such and such would have been voiced differently, like a theta or something like that. But
I would agree. By the way, one of the things you mentioned is that charismatic is directly related to the name of these hot chicks.
Well, yes, and here's a, I can hear the philosophers of language objecting, philosophy of language prostitutes objecting, because they'll say, like, given the evolution, looking at the evolution of language, you can't always stretch your modern usage based on a strict etymology, you know, a strict etymology of where something came from. You know, frankly, and the one classic example I used with you, you know, long ago is that we're still walking around saying Woden saying Thursday, and we don't even realize it, but we still do it. And when you say Wednesday, you don't think of Woden, and when you say Thursday, you don't think of Thor.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know,
but then,
no,
but then
know,
I'm not trying to create a divine theology based upon the pagan name either, and that was the context that Paul used it. We're at the end of our time. We can pursue this again tomorrow, Glenn. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.